straight out of an Econ 101 textbook. You got two freshly minted MBAs, all right? Investor A and Investor B. Investor A has a portfolio that most people would consider well-diversified. He's got some holdings in small cap, mid cap, large cap. He's got some things that are secure, some things that are high risk. He's got some things in a variety of sectors. Pretty good spread. Investor B, he really likes tech. He loves tech. It's so cool. He's got a lot of money in it and very little anywhere else. And, you know, tech's been doing all right for the past couple years, so it's in a lot of red. Okay, so far so good? Make sense? Party question. Which investor is dumb? A or B?
B.
B! You would win a prize, except you're going to get one of these. Investor B is dumb. He's breaking, I mean, maybe he's got some insider info or something, in which case he's probably going to be incarcerated. But barring that, he's breaking almost all the rules. He, to quote my grandmother, he's put all of his eggs in one basket. And if that basket would drop, he's going to be in deep trouble. If for some reason the tech sector would tank, he's going to lose a bazooka load of money. I don't know. If you diversify your portfolio, you protect yourself against catastrophic changes, catastrophic collapse. It allows you also to benefit from a variety of mild gains rather than, you know, the chance of one huge gain. It's a good strategy to diversify. Make sense? Well, it is my opinion that our agricultural policy has, since about the early 70s or so, been pretty much pursuing the strategy of Investor B, which I happen to think is dumb. Okay, our farming system, which used to be diversified, spread all across the country, patchwork of farms across our land, has now been concentrating. It's been concentrating a lot. It's been doing this over the past few decades in particular. Now, all of our foods come from just a few areas of the country, and typically only a few varieties are grown within those areas, okay? So in the Midwest, which used to be the traditional home of farming, now you're gonna find, who knows what you're gonna find in the Midwest right now?
Corn.
Corn?
Soybeans.
Soybeans. Corn and soy. Corn on soy on corn, sometimes corn on corn. Depends on how much the ethanol boom's going. Some places like Kansas, you're gonna find wheat. You're gonna find wheat sometimes in Idaho, legumes, rice. That's about it. Not exactly bountiful harvest here. All of the vegetables and fruits in the supermarket that you see, more or less, come from
California
and
Florida.
Very good. Or third world countries, probably. Or undeveloped countries. That's where we get our food. That's where you get what you eat. Okay. Make sense? In the 80s, small farmers pretty much went the way of the dodo. They got swallowed up one after the other by agribusiness. It was on a rant act. And this was policy that was spurred on by the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, Earl Butts, one of my favorite people, who exhorted everybody to get big or get out. He said, plant fence row to fence row, and that is what you see now. You don't see patchwork farms, you don't see integrated farms, you see corn. Lots and lots of corn. Over the course of the 20th century, mostly in the last half of it, the percentage of farmers in America fell from about 30% of the population to right now, just about 2. Average age of the farmer today is 65. Farming is in its death throes in America right now. And this is bad. This is really bad. Okay. I'm going to explain to you in some detail why I think this is bad, but I hope just prima facie looking at this, you're like, what? 65, did you say? There's some environmental reasons, there's safety reasons, and there's economic reasons why this is bad. Some of these are going to be problems in the future, and some of them are problems right now. So I'm going to pick them off one by one, and I'm going to give a very brief sketch of each. Believe me, you could have entire classes on any one of these. Okay. First one, environmental. Starts there. Gotta talk about the environmental problems. That's pretty well explored. You can find this information in a lot of places, and so I'm not gonna spend a lot of time on it. Probably there's gonna be some displays set up over in the HMSU where you can find all kinds of information about the problems with our current agricultural policy and environmentalism. Agribusiness input to get the output of food. It takes vast quantities of fuel to run the machinery. It takes a lot of fertilizer to get the crops to grow in what's depleted soil. Both of these cause health and environmental problems, and you're probably already familiar with a lot of them, but I'm going to talk about one maybe you haven't heard of. Depends on what book you've been reading. Anybody? I want to see a show of hands. Has anybody here ever heard of blue baby days? You grow pollen. Anybody else? Blue baby days are alert days that people in Des Moines, Iowa get, sort of like smog alerts you get in Los Angeles, of course. On blue baby days, it is not safe to give babies tap water because the nitrate concentration in the water is so high from the agricultural fertilizer that it'll interfere with the baby's ability to process oxygen. Yeah, that's just on the news, you know, the traffic blocked on Highway 40. Oh, and by the way, the water will kill your kid today. This is okay with people? This is okay. Yeah, okay, great. So we have blue baby days. There's one example of a serious environmental policy. Believe me, there's lots and lots more. I'm gonna skip on to safety. There's safety issues. Not just environmental. I like to think that blue baby days is something of a safety issue, but there's some basic ones involved just in the food policy. How many of you guys remember the great spinach recall a couple years ago? You remember that? You go to the store and you cannot find a bag of spinach anywhere. No cut, no fresh, nothing. It's gone, right? It was for like a month. Okay, what gives? What happens? You couldn't even find organic, conventional organic, all brands. Well, all that spinach got contaminated with E. coli. How? Okay, some, sure. How did all of the spinach in America, almost all major brands, all across the great United States, how did these all get contaminated with E. coli? This is bizarre. They were all grown by different companies, more or less. Turns out that, in fact, they were all grown by different companies, but they were all grown in the Salinas Valley. They were all processed in basically the same place. Contamination hit the processing plant. There went an entire crop of spinach. To quote Michael Pollan here, all of our spinach is being washed in the same sink. Now, there are, you know, serious health code restrictions that should prevent this sort of thing from happening, but that's what happens when you get concentrated agriculture. Same issue goes for meat, probably a whole lot more so than spinach. Meat is very susceptible to contamination. Very, you know, you have to handle this stuff very carefully. When you're processing meat in a diversified system, you're gonna have lots and lots and lots and lots of processing plants. They're gonna be very local. You don't have to ship the meat very far. And if there's a problem, it gets contained. It gets contained quickly. There could be problems. People can get sick. People can die, but it would be small, okay? We're talking about somebody left up the mayonnaise dip at grandma's birthday party, not, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds recalls. Whenever you have a concentrated system like ours, which has four companies now controlling 80% of the meat processing, you have thousands and thousands of animals processed at each facility every day. Think about what happens if some kind of contamination gets into that process. It's catastrophic and it is incredibly difficult to contain, especially since the USDA actually doesn't have the power to force a recall. They can strongly suggest or encourage you to recall, but they can't make any companies recall anything. It's voluntary. All right. So, this is just what happens when you have mishaps and mistakes. Not a big fan of fear-mongering. I don't like scaring people, but I do like knowing where actual threats come from. And so I want you to think for a second about what's already happened in our system and, you know, the current hamburger threat level we're living under. I want you to think about whether or not it's a plausible target for bioterrorism. I am not going to tell you one way or the other. I'm going to let you make your own mind up on that one. But I am going to tell you what Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, said about this. And he said, quote, "For the life of me, I cannot understand why terrorists have not attacked our food supply because it is so easy to do." And on that note, we'll move on to economics. So there's the safety of our food supply. Yes. Economics. Okay, here we get to some of the problems that are only now starting to come home. They're going to get worse and worse. Obviously, the move to agribusiness mega farms, it was a disaster for the small farmers in the 80s. But they're gone now. Who cares? Right? What are some other problems? Okay, I mentioned earlier, agribusiness farms require huge inputs in fuel and fertilizer. And in fact, fertilizers typically come from fuel. They come from natural gas. That's almost always how it's made. As oil and gas prices start to rise, food prices are going to start to rise. We're already seeing this starting to happen. There's a lot of reasons for the spike in food prices, but that's one of them. Agribusiness has worked for the past 30 years or so because fuel was cheap. Well, it's not going to be cheap forever. I don't know what the breaking point is. I don't know when, how expensive oil has to get before it's no longer economical to farm the way we do now. But I'm guessing it's going to happen at some point. Let's see. In some cases, if you've been paying attention, the price of grains have doubled and actually tripled in the past month, 2 months, give or take, something like that. Yeah, I had a friend call me in a panic, like, do you want to make a Wheat Montana order now? Why? Well, because wheat prices have doubled and they're going to triple pretty soon. Yeah? She's terrified about this. And that's nothing compared to other places. I mean, we're talking about our own pocketbook costs. There's a real human cost here in places like Haiti. Have you heard about what's happened in Haiti recently? There have been serious food riots in many, many third world countries recently. Haiti being the worst of them, where they just overthrew their government last week over the cost of food. People are actually buying mud pies. I almost thought this was a joke when I was reading it, that they are buying pies made of mud, water, and spices?
Sugar, too.
Sugar, that's right, sugar. Because that's what they can afford to eat. That is what our agricultural system is bringing. We're not feeding the world with anything right now. There's also externalized costs. Anybody know what an externalized cost is? Besides the economist. What's an externalized cost?
It's a cost that's not included in what you pay for the product.
Yeah, it's not on the bottom line. It's not included in what you pay. It's usually not included on the ConAgra's books, something like that. These may or may not remain externalized, depending on how our food policy goes. There's a lot of things that they don't pay for that maybe they ought to be. For example, agribusiness doesn't currently incur any or many expenses for the Gulf of Mexico dead zones that their fertilizers are causing. They're not incurring any costs for the incredibly high contribution to greenhouse emissions. They don't pay for that. They don't even incur costs for the blue baby alerts. I mean, unless maybe they voluntarily mail something to the radio station, they pay for a stamp. They don't incur any costs for that. These things could change. As policy changes, or might change, these things might start becoming things they have to pay for, and that is going to transfer to our pocketbooks, the cost of food. And probably it should. The system, we ought to be paying a lot more for the food than we are. And if policymakers don't force agribusiness to pay for their share of these problems, we're gonna pay for it in higher healthcare costs, we're gonna pay for it in air quality diminishment, we're gonna pay for it in agricultural subsidies, in toxic cleanup sites, and believe it or not, there are farmers that count as toxic cleanup sites. We're eating this stuff, guys. We're going to pay for it in rising food prices and increasing riots, and we're all going to pay for it a lot with all these greenhouse emissions. And we're going to start losing farmable land, we're going to start losing stable growing climates because of climate destabilization. This is not pretty. So that's a sketch of the problem, a really, really brief sketch of some of the problems with our agricultural policy. Okay, does this make sense so far? You all ready to storm Kroger's and stick it to the produce manager? Okay, we live in some pretty interesting times, and there are things that are beginning to change. Okay, so we can wait for policy to change, and I think the policy change is a good thing, but it's not the only thing. There was an incredible flap created by what's the typically innocuous food and farm bill. This is a thing that goes through the Senate maybe, I think, every 5 years or so. And this is just a no-brainer, they think of it as a sleepy day on the floor, they'll, write it up, they'll vote on it, and all of a sudden they started getting phone calls and angry people showing up in the Senate chamber wanting to know what is going on with this food and farm bill, and all the senators are like, why do you care? You've never cared in the grand history of the food and farm bill. Farm Bill. But people are really up in arms about this now. There are publications in the New York Times about the Food and Farm Bill from people like Michael Pollan, my own personal patron saint. In the 80s and a lot of the 90s, if you wanted to eat at all, you pretty much had to play by agribusiness's rules. They controlled everything. Or you could go off-grid and become a homesteader, which wasn't a hugely popular option, although people certainly took it. After decades of growing dissent, the market is actually starting to respond to this. It's taken a while, but it is starting. It is increasingly possible to work outside of the agribusiness system, and it's in fact possible to opt out of it entirely, and you don't even have to go off-grid to do it anymore. It's just hard. It's a skill set. The hallmark of the opt-out, it revolves around this move to relocalization, part two of the talk, relocalization. There's this, a lot of catchphrases that we use in association with this movement you might have heard of, like localvore, 100-mile diet, delete it. Yeah, the movement actually does have a bit of an elitist background in as much as it really was helped along by some of the high-end restaurants that were looking for the freshest, most recently picked vegetable. And that helped a lot. That helped stabilize a lot of small farms. But it's broadened. It's grown hugely since those days. Today, it is not restricted to the rich few. It can actually be a more economical way to live. And it's even from the perspective of a household, household economics. But it takes some time to learn. Relocalizing our agricultural system, it could put a stop to almost all of the problems that I was just talking about for our major agricultural system. It'll have its own problems, there's no doubt about that. But the ones I was just listing, it could put a stop to. And simply because it's more diversified. That's all it takes. Contamination problems, they could still happen, but they're gonna be contained. You're gonna take out 12 people at your family picnic rather than the state of Nebraska with an E. coli outbreak. Most of the environmental problems that are incurred by agribusiness, they pretty much won't come up, at least not in a well-managed, smaller farm. Even if a local farm's goods aren't certified organic, usually they are organic or real, real close to it, because it's not in their economic interest to use all of these high input techniques. It doesn't make sense on a small farm the way it does on a large farm. And in fact, since it's local, you want to know, you can ask the farmer, how did you grow this? And they can tell you. And if you don't believe them, you can go and look. It's probably within 10, 15 miles away. Go ahead and try that with ConAgra sometime. Give them a call. Ask them how they're growing their crops. Let me know how that went for you. It's not going to go well. For all that, the economic benefits are probably some of the most underappreciated, but I think they're actually some of the most precious benefits. Some of the best ones that we can get out of this field. In a relocalized agricultural system, the money you spend on the food that you feed your family is staying in the community. It's contributing to your own tax pool. It's rather than, I don't know, somebody in New York City, some of the shareholders of Cargill, whoever that money is going to, it's sure not staying here. I don't know where it's going, but it's not here. Local food purchases, they directly support people you know, farmers that you can talk with. You are buying their food and helping to support their family and their way of life. They have a vested interest in keeping you happy and keeping you safe, partially because it's good business, partially because they're going to have to look you in the eye and explain why your kid got sick when they ate your chicken. They don't want to do that. They don't want to be in that uncomfortable position. So they're going to do their best to keep you safe for moral reasons. Craziness. Relocalized systems are also far more self-sufficient than concentrated food systems, and this is something that isn't as well understood as it probably should be. As I mentioned at the beginning, all of our fruits and vegetables are pretty much grown in two states, right? What happens if there's a drought in one of those states? Are we going to rely exclusively on Florida's food crop when California goes down or vice versa? What happens if there's a virulent outbreak of something or other? Because everybody's planting monocrops, they're planting the same varieties. Not only are they planting it all in the same place, but they're planting the same stuff. It's just going to go through like wildfire. If I'm not mistaken, there's actually a new disease in wheat. It's a rust disease. It's been imported from Iran, is that true? Something like that. And it's causing huge problems with the wheat crop. So I don't think we've seen the end of the price hike for wheat just yet. If we had farmers spread across the nation that was growing, that were growing the basic foods that we eat, this wouldn't be as big a deal. You're still gonna have drought. That's still gonna happen. But it's not gonna be catastrophic. It's not gonna take out half of our food supply if you have a drought. It's not gonna cause them to massively deplete aquifers trying to irrigate their fields if we have a drought. The drought-stricken area, they can rely on their own food reserves. They can rely on the surrounding areas coming to the fore, helping them out with food. That's the way it actually always has worked. And say what you want to about the past, there are some things to recommend this. It worked fairly well. And besides, who wants to be beholden to California for your food? I like to think that I can feed myself. Thank you very much. I don't need California to help me out here. Yeah. Maybe because I'm a Midwestern girl. I don't know. I'm just thinking against California. So these are some of my current ruminations on the agricultural system, the stunning mess that it is, and ways I'd like to see it change. And it is changing. In the past few years, you can see this even in Terre Haute. We've got a farmer's market now, and it's getting bigger every year. It's really cool. We have at least two community-supported agriculture programs, and they're doing really well. And if you don't know what that is, you need to ask me, because they're awesome. We've got a growing preference among the whole population that if you can buy it locally, it's better. You're not so much on the fringe anymore if you say, I'd like to get it local. So creating and sustaining a local food system is why a group of us have gotten together to form a local food cooperative here in Terre Haute. And there's actually a hefty percentage of the steering committee in the room right now, in fact. Okay, do you guys know what a cooperative is? What the business model is? How many of you guys do? Not counting the steering committee. The idea behind a cooperative, really, really straightforwardly, is that it's a business which is owned by the community members that use it. You know, in a retail cooperative like this, anybody can shop there. You know, somebody from Nebraska can come through and shop there. But you have the option to buy a membership, buy some equity in the store, and you become a member and an owner. Every share costs the same. People can only buy one share. One share, one vote. Everybody gets an equal say. It's not run by whoever owns the most shares wins, like a Xerox or something. And that's the way a cooperative business basically works. And I actually happen to think that this cooperative model has a bit of an edge over the other more traditional business models, especially in agriculture. So I want to say a little bit about why I think creating a cooperative market is so valuable. I mean, okay. The ability to supply local foods is not restricted to co-ops. There's no reason that Kroger's and Walmart couldn't do this in principle. They can go to the local farms, they can buy local goods, bring it and sell it there. They would. And this is wonderful. To the extent that it happens, it's good. It should be encouraged. Baseless actually does this. Not maybe as much as I'd like to see, but they actually supply some local stuff when they get the chance. And that's a very good thing. All right, well, the big difference here, and the main reason why co-ops are going to be better at this, I think, than Kroger's and Walmart, co-ops don't operate on this typical growth economy model. Many co-ops are even incorporated as not-for-profit entities. Stores as not-for-profit. Record better than that. All right, a co-op is a weird business, and that the people who come together to own the business, all these community members, they're not in it for the money. Or if they are, they need to take an economics course. They don't understand the situation. You buy into a co-op not to make money, not for the monster dividend check at the end of the year, but because you care about your community, you care about the store, you think that the store benefits the community in a variety of ways. And it's a place where you live nicer. It does this in part by providing additional goods and services like local and organic foods. It also does this through community services, community engagement. Co-ops are often headlining things like community gardens, community kitchens, cooking classes, all those sorts of things. So what? All right. So they do all these really great things with the community. Why is this so useful? Well, most supermarkets, like Kroger's and Walmart's, are beholden to profit. They're very beholden to profit. And they run on economies of scale. And what this mostly means is that what's more important than anything to Kroger's is making sure, not just they make a profit, but that they have a large profit, a large enough profit that they can give money to their investors and keep their investors happy. This, in turn, means that they have to drive their prices of operations down as far as they can, right? That means they have to drive down their wholesale costs as far as they can. The ultra-low prices that they need to be able to buy the food at are losses that huge firms like Conagra and ABM, they can handle those losses, especially since not a lot of their products are subsidized by taxation anyway. But small and medium-sized farms, they can't drop their prices that low. This is what they live on. They can't sell, they can't compete with Cargill whenever they go on the wholesale market. Co-ops, on the other hand, they don't have this problem. We're not trying to make sure that there's this big monster, you know, patronage refund check for people at the end of the year. It's nice. All co-ops need is enough money to make sure that the store is sustained, and whatever little is left over, and there often is a little left over, it does go back to the owners. It goes back into patronage refund. But this is not something you want to plan your IRA around. Okay, this is like, you know, a little bonus check to help out with Thanksgiving dinner or something like that. And consequently, when local co-ops deal directly with farmers, they're paying them directly. They have a little more space. They can pay a little more to the smaller farmers and still charge fairly competitive prices for those goods at their store. They don't have to make this big profit margin the way that Walmart and Kroger's does. Co-ops, they don't have the same scale of cost. They don't have to pay for huge overhead, advertising campaigns, things like that. They do. These co-ops do have advertising, they do have overhead, but nothing like what Kroger's does. Nothing like what Walmart does. And so co-ops actually have a business model that gives farmers a stable and secure source of income. It's more stable than a farmer's market, which are wonderful, and I love farmer's markets dearly. I think they're the best thing ever. But stores, a standing store with regular business hours, is going to be a more secure source of income for these farmers than just a farmer's market. And it allows them to expand a little bit more. And, best of all, it's going to actually supply some diversity to our system that right now is desperately lacking. It'll give people an incentive to go into farming right here, not out in California. So far, so good? So we have this last little bit. This is the part where I go all idealist, like I haven't already. This is where I really wax idealist on this. I would actually suggest to you that co-op serves a very important social role within our communities. Cooperative businesses, I think, I can't believe I'm going to say this out loud. I'm a cynic. I swear I'm a cynic. Cooperative businesses actually offer you a way to find happiness within our current economic model. Stay with me here. I'm serious. Cooperatives encourage community engagement. They encourage paying attention to the welfare of others, on getting to know your neighbors. You're going to be owning a business with these people. Now, it doesn't mean you need to, you know, be showing up at every single board meeting, but it means you have a real and meaningful connection with the other people that you share in this ownership relationship. And hopefully it will encourage you, one, to be, you know, to show up for some of these classes, to maybe run a cooking class yourself, things like that. Co-ops offer individuals a way to come together, to learn to cooperate again, neat thought, both for the benefit of yourself and for the benefit of everybody. And this is a lifestyle that has been shown repeatedly to make people happier, more satisfied with their lives, with their homes, and it doesn't rely on this blind consumption of products that you don't need. And really, if you think about it, you probably don't even want. Despite what our current administration would have us believe, the American way of life, it is negotiable. It really is. He just said the other day, the American way of life is not negotiable. Yeah, it is. Not only is it negotiable, but it really needs to be renegotiated because we're in danger now. Our lifestyle is
extracting huge amounts of good from the earth, putting very little back, and this is a train that's going to run out of track before too long. This lifestyle needs to change somehow. Co-ops are actually one way of trying to show you how it could change, how it could be better and happy without needing all this crap, basically. So if you revalue your community and you reject endless consumption while still buying food, that's good. It's got to be at the heart of this change, and co-ops can be a part of that change, and it shows us one way to make genuine local economies and communities function again. We can all be happy. And that is my talk. I'm sure there will be some. I'm sure that that happens. But that is no longer a reliable mechanism. And that's one of the real problems. It's a pretty common thing to hear out of the older generation of farmers. Their kids don't want to go into this. And who can blame them? I mean, one of the things they didn't talk about at all in our agricultural system is the stunning level of debt that these farmers are suffering under. And their kids are watching, you know, their dad and mom being under 2 and 3 mortgages just to pay for these ginormous combines and things like that. I wouldn't want to go into that. If that's what I thought farming is, where they are barely making ends meet, they're praying for the subsidy because that's all that's helping them in sort of the mid to large size family farms that are still left. It is not pretty. And I don't know what people are saying in the sort of the smaller family farms that are starting to be up and coming. Maybe those are more positive, maybe not. Maybe the kids are looking at this going, this is nuts, man, I'm going to the city. I don't know what they think. But in my idealistic state, I like to think that kids that grow up on these smaller, more genuine family farms have a better view of it. But I don't know. Good question. Yeah?
Have you come across any data on the growth of the local?
No, and in fact, I've seen people talk about that, and an awful lot of the problem, that's false. There are statistics on things like farmers markets.
Yeah.
And farmers markets have grown exponentially. I'm not going to get the numbers right, but it's something like a 20-fold since the early 90s growth, at least. If I had the numbers, it would be something like, you know, from 800 to 35,000. So there's that measure, which is a pretty reliable measure. It's a good one. Also, a lot of what happens under the table, it's hard to get a good. So, for example, people want to know what the actual, average income of a lot of these sort of small farmers and farmers that do CSAs or farmers markets is. We don't really know because they don't report it all the time. So a lot of this is very. It's not just sort of opting out of agribusiness, it's a little bit opting out of the entire system. I don't know how I feel about that, per se. I'm not trying to encourage that, but that's a problem with getting that data. But if you find any data besides just the farmer's markets or you're aware of it, I'd love to see it. There's actually a couple of things I think that are worth saying there. One is for the vegetables, like the vegetables and fruit, those basically don't have any regulation. Those aren't, you don't have to meet any USDA standards. Nobody at the farmer's market that's selling vegetables and things like that, they don't have to meet any sort of standard. So there's a sense in which you're not going to have much more of an increased cost of monitoring that, but with any luck with a smaller farm, I would hope they do a better job of being able to tell if they've got a problem than you would be able to on a sort of 20,000 acre farm. Meat and dairy and eggs, on the other hand, is a problem, and it's a problem now, because the USDA cannot, this is this massive struggle actually right now between small meat producers and the USDA and ConAgra and big meat, Tyson, people like that. Because in order to sell meat, you have to butcher it under certain approved facilities. And most approved facilities, that means you have to have a on-site or a recently inspected USDA inspector there. Facilities that can't, the USDA just doesn't have that much money when it comes right down to it. They have trouble getting enough inspectors out to all of these different processing plants, and so processing plants are shutting down. The ones that are left typically aren't interested in processing 20 head of cattle or 400 head of cattle. If you're not bringing them 2,000 today, they are not going to talk to you. And that's leaving a lot of the smaller producers sort of out in the cold. They can't sell their meat without having processed in these plants. So there's a real struggle. And I don't know. I mean, there might be something like a cowship workaround where I'm not buying the meat, I'm buying the cow. I don't even know if that would work. But that is going to be a real problem. In my ideal world, people would just stop eating so much bloody meat. But, sorry. And I think that if our country did, and in fact probably has to, move to the system, maybe even kicking and screaming, I think it's going to happen that meat consumption is just going to reduce radically. Now, I don't know what to do about that problem. That is to me, as far as I can tell, that is a genuine problem with our system.
There could potentially be meat producers cooperatives or something like that, where they, you know, sort of make that economy of scale by all coming together and having their meat processed in that way, sort of like Organic Valley, Dairy Valley.
Okay. So like, you know, like in this area, maybe you have the, and maybe they already even do this. I actually don't know, but maybe like Royers and Jaeger, the Swiss Connection people, and there's L&A Farms and five or six others, maybe they all get together. And I know there are actually some very small processors, because we have friends that take their chickens to them. So there are still some very small producers, but if you read the blog The Epicurean, which I highly recommend, it's a great blog, this is a continuum struggle back and forth between the USDA, between the meat producers, between Cargill, between all of them. It ain't great. Other questions? I answered all your questions. Did nobody ask? Yeah.
This isn't really being talked about, but I remember hearing last year there was a huge percent of the honeybees that had died that were pollinating plants. What is the effect of that on the production of cigarettes?
Bad. Very bad. I'm actually, does anybody know where it's called colony collapse disorder. And does anybody know where we are on that these days?
The last time I heard, people were looking into it, but no one has done anything definitive. But the biggest problem is that honeybees are disappearing in large masses and nobody knows what's happening to them.
Yeah.
Like, nobody has any idea if they're just moving somewhere else.
Where are they going?
Sit somewhere else. They just, like, boop, disappear off the map.
Yeah, I know they've looked into two or three, at least two or three flaws. I mean, they've looked into pesticides and genetically modified crops. They've looked into cell phone towers. They've looked into all kinds of things. Last I heard, the most plausible running theory had to do with an Iranian, or why do I keep saying Iranian? Israeli mice. For all of that, they were looking at like 80, 90% losses of their bee population. And that just can't be good for open pollinated plants. There are going to be some plants where it's not going to matter before they're self-pollinated. And so, you know, we're going to be swimming in green beans. We're golden on green beans. But as I think it looks all pollinated. But anything that's not, you know, not like spinach and your fruit plants, things like that. I don't know what they're gonna do. Someone suggested, actually there was some suggestion that part of the problem was, comes back to the concentration model again, that what they would do is you got these honeybee hives that they will transport, I'm not making this up, I could make this up if I wanted to, 2,500 miles across country to pollinate
almonds
and to pollinate oranges. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had a brain the size of dust, light as dust, and I'm being trucked 2,500 miles, I'm going to be a little disturbed. And maybe I'm thinking, my first chance to get the hell out of here, I'm taking my hive and I'm booking. I don't know. But at least one plausible candidate that they were looking into, and even if it's not causing colony collapse or it's just stupid, it stresses out the bees manifestly, is this trucking a beehive back and forth across the country. Come on, people, don't we have something better to do with our gas than this? Just put the bees out in California. Why is this hard? But they don't want to do that. There's a great story I picked up somewhere along the line where there's a Danish company that makes sugar cookies. They ship them to America. An American company that makes sugar cookies. It's a Danish. Somebody's like, couldn't they have just swapped recipes? Seems like there are saner ways to do this stuff.
You know the price of X has been in the past year?
The price of what?
The price of X of all the bees now.
No, I don't know. I haven't actually seen much of a price change in vegetable crops that would link up to that. That could just be that the big companies are absorbing it somehow. You want to hear one of the really psycho things about our agriculture policy that I didn't bring up in here? So you're familiar with ag subsidies? All right, this is another one of those, I couldn't make this up if I tried. According to our current agricultural policy, if you have land that you are growing things on, and it is in the agricultural subsidy program, which means it covers wheat, corn, soy, rice,
Cotton.
There may be one or two other products, I'm not sure. If, for any reason, you decide to plant a non-subsidized plant on that land, you can never bring it back into the system of subsidies again. Talk about a disincentive. I've got my father, stepfather-in-law. He owns a family farm out in Shelbyville. It's pretty big one. He's got several thousand acres worth of land. It's corn on soy. I talked to him about, he thought about letting, and it's rented out. It's a sharecropper who does it. Like, if he thought about renting it out to somebody else doing, CSA or a more diversified farm, he can't. If he does, he's never going to be able to bring the land back into the subsidy program. And I don't blame him. I mean, that would be personally, economically, dicey move. That would be a real leap of faith for him. There's a disincentive for this. There was actually a proposal in the Food and Farm Bill for the Indiana experiment where they were going to, let's see what happens if we suspend that rule in Indiana. I have no idea if it made it through or not. I know that California and Florida were pitching a fit. I don't know if the Food and Farm Bill is not done, but I don't know if it's been excised or not. Does anybody know? I'd be dying to know. If we get the Indiana exception, that would be funny. Other questions? Yeah?
I know that asking why is a bit of a hard question, but I was told that we are now trying to grow rice in the desert southwest where there's no water, so we're effectively flooding parts of desert to grow rice.
What? You're joking, right?
I'm dead serious. That seems
I'm a trained philosopher, and my husband is on the philosophy faculty here. We pride ourselves on being able to look seriously at deep, complex questions and take things that other people normally wouldn't seriously. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I have no idea why anybody would do that. I have some friends actually that live in Phoenix, right? My dad, even, he lives in Phoenix right now. And they talk about, well, we can't just have a localized economy. We can't grow food out here. I'm like, you think maybe that means John Houghton lives there? Just a suggestion, but you could move elsewhere where there's water and dirt. Just a thought. I'm curious what's going to happen to the Southwest. I mean, certainly people have lived there. I mean, lived there for eons. It is possible. Is it possible to sustain a city like Phoenix? Depends on how generous California is feeling, I guess. I am reasonably convinced that our country is going to have to move to this system, whether we want to or not. If we want to, it might happen sooner. If we don't want to, it's going to be under duress and later, and it's going to look like, probably a lot like what happened to either Cuba. If we're lucky, it'll look like what happened to Cuba. If we're unlucky, it's going to look like what happened to the Soviet Union. But somehow or other, it's going to change. And when it does, I don't know what's going to happen to people trying to grow rice in the media Southwest. I hope they write me and let me know how it's going for them. I think there might be an awful lot of people pretty angry with them that they'd like to drink that water, please, but wash their clothes, maybe. Unless they let them wash their clothes in the rice paddies, I guess that's nice. Maybe there's some cooperative. That is definitely the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Okay, thank you for that. Thank you. What else? Nobody asked me about CSAs. Does everybody know what a CSA is? CSAs actually rock a lot. They're a stopgap for small farms, actually. It's a subscription service. It's a bit of a risk. You buy a share in a farm at the beginning of the season. It usually costs between $350 and $450 for the entire season. And every week you get a box of the freshest, most recently picked, wonderful vegetables that this farmer has to offer you. It's really nice for the farmer in that that provides him with a stable income. It's really nice for the people that get it, and that typically you end up getting a little more produce than you paid for. If you're looking at market values, like how much you'd have paid for all the stuff produce, you'll get a bit more out of your CSA than you would have if you've been buying it all. It also forces you to use things, use a lot more vegetables than you ordinarily would. Forces you to use it in season. Yeah, I mean, man, I'll default to my bean and mushroom stroganoff every night, but I got this kohlrabi sitting looking at me, and I got to figure out what to do with it. What is a kohlrabi? It looks like a spaceship.
Oh, you just eat it raw.
Well, see, I learned this. I didn't know. I got a kohlrabi in our CSA last year. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is a football?
We must have just gotten one, because I didn't get one.
We split a turn. But, you know, I looked it up, and hey, there's a great kohlrabi slaw. I learned something new, and I integrated a whole new vegetable into our lives. It's a good vegetable, and I like it a lot. So I'm a big fan of CSAs, and the more that we can support these farmers, the better off everybody's going to be. Okay? Anyone else? Thank you for coming. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me. You
win the bag.
You win the bag. You asked good questions. You asked a bunch of them. You win the bag. We have a Terra Foods canvas bag, which you can use to cut your greenhouse emissions by taking it to the grocery store and annoying the bagger. Right with me.
Grocery.